It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. President Joe Biden signed a $1 trillion infrastructure bill into law November 15th. Pennsylvania is poised to receive billions of dollars for investments in infrastructure, broadband, and more. As the days go by, we're getting some more specifics. What about the impact on transit? Catherine Kelman is the CEO of the Port Authority of Allegheny County. Welcome back to the Confluence, Catherine.
Thanks for having us today, Kevin.
And we're also joined by David Huffaker. He's Chief Development Officer for the Transit Agency. David, good to have you with us.
Hello, great to be here.
Governor Wolf had indicated Pennsylvania expects to receive $2.8 billion over 5 years to improve public transportation options. Catherine, what portion of funding are you anticipating?
That is an excellent question, Kevin. So we know we have this big infrastructure deal, which has been passed, and we are still waiting through to see the numbers. We are optimistic that our region could see up to $100 million, but we don't know how that slices and dices. And I don't even have really good confirmation on that number. I will say there are a lot of really beneficial programs in the bill that can be really helpful for us. And that is even separate from the amounts that we're talking about coming back to the Commonwealth as a whole.
Mm-hmm. David, what kind of investment would you like to see if there is a big influx of funds, when that influx does come, whatever the level it happens to be?
As you probably know, we just completed and our board adopted Next Transit, which is our 25-year long-range plan. That effort identified a number of projects that would be of significance to the region. That would range everything from the highest priority corridor, which is a connection that we call the river-to-river connection that would connect from Lawrenceville or the Strip District up into the Hill District and Oakland and down to Hazelwood. And that would be an opportunity. Some of the funding could at least provide some studies for how we would best serve that corridor and provide some future connections there. But we also have projects that would be around a downtown transit center that would provide a place for the Port Authority service to be concentrated downtown and provide some improved customer amenities and any number of items to study future expansion, perhaps for the East Busway.
David, remind us about the river to river. We're very familiar with the East Busway and all the ideas, the proposals to expand it. But what about the river to river? How would that help?
Well, the river to river connection, and I say connection because we have not determined what would be the appropriate mode of choice on how to serve this, but it would restore some historic lack of investment in transit connections, particularly for the Hill District, but also for Hazelwood, and would enable us to connect the current growing job centers and some of the high-tech industry that you see in the Strip District or in Lawrenceville to places where people could take advantage of those opportunities, whether it's in Hazelwood or it's in the Hill, as well as connecting to Oakland and all of the educational opportunities there and provide connections for getting to shopping and hospitals and other essential services that people need and they have somewhat been left on an island. And so this would be a chance to restore some of those connections.
Catherine, what can you move forward on the quickest with this infrastructure money?
Well, the fastest thing we could probably move forward on would be wrapping up our design projects for, again, River to River and East Busway and a bus garage. We do have smaller projects, though, that would be competitive. For instance, Congressman Lamb had made sure that we were looking at the Carnegie Park and Ride. Ultimately, that becomes a station, we hope. And there is $10 million in funding laid out for that. This infrastructure bill could help us get more funding for that and move it faster, as well as, you know, redesign at Station Square or the new projects at Dormont Junction Station and the design charrettes we just wrapped up at South Hills Junction. These are station projects that we can move on really quickly that you can see you could see us breaking ground within a few years as opposed to maybe a 5-year horizon.
I was just going to add to that. We do have A number of projects that are already in the pipeline. We're going to be completing improvements at the McKeesport Transit Center. That's one that will be opening early next year. We also have a contract to improve the Negley Station on the East Busway. But historically, we have underinvested in some of our customer facilities. So that's why it's that investment that we might have some opportunities here with this new infrastructure bill, that some of the opportunities that Catherine was describing would be so important for providing a better customer experience and improved access for people with disabilities and the like.
In September of this year, Port Authority approved a $3.8 billion 25-year plan to reimagine transit in the region. You know, this is a 25-year plan, as I said. So things are going to be happening incrementally. Give us a snapshot of what can happen during those 25 years.
So we have identified a number of corridors, such as that river-to-river connection. We will be beginning to do some studies to develop what the appropriate mode of choice would be and what a representative project would be to serve those corridors, and make sure that we're connecting back to the public to say, here is what we heard from you, and here's a project that we've identified. Does this meet your needs? And it helps to have that conversation. We also are going to be doing some somewhat behind the scenes or behind the curtain type work as we do a facilities master study. And Catherine referred earlier to a fifth bus garage. We also need to determine what's going to happen with our maintenance facilities. We have a very extensive set of infrastructure right now that's maintained at facilities, primarily South Hills Junction, but South Hills Village as well. We also have facilities that are along the East Busway, just adjacent to the Pennsylvanian. And identifying how best to support our service through this facilities master plan, so that we can determine what's the best use of our current facilities. How are we going to use our Manchester location, which we use for heavy maintenance right now? And then what are some of the opportunities with our other bus garages? Those will be some of the first things we work on. I think you'll see a lot on the East Busway as well, as we look at providing improved customer facilities for what's there, as well as extensions of the busway into the future.
Catherine?
Kevin, this is really where we talk about what is the big dream, right? Not flying cars per se, but, you know, imagine if everything in this plan is built out, what that means for not driving yourself. And not just, you know, so it's bus transit, but it is the ability to be able to walk easily to and from your bus stop with your grocery bag, or physical improvements throughout the county. So you're not just waiting on the street corner, you know, you're waiting at a facility that, you know, Dream a Little Dream has maybe a dry cleaning drop off or a coffee shop, or, you know, at least a restroom or a place you can wait outside of the elements. I think about 24-hour service. That's one of my, you know, one of my creative core elements. I would love to see us be able to get folks, you know, not miss that gap from 2 to 4 a.m., but be able to get people home from work or get into those earlier shifts. We have a really, really great foundation to start from. And especially when you compare us to our friends around the country that during COVID couldn't get people home at 11 p.m. or they couldn't get folks home late on weekends. Just imagine this place where all these improvements are embedded and it's easy to pay and the information is right there in front of you. That's really what we're talking about 25 years out.
In the past, the Port Authority had to earmark federal funds for very specific projects. With the infrastructure dollars, do you have a little more flexibility, a little more leeway? Do you have to say, this is what we're using federal infrastructure funds for? Or is it like, trust us, we need these improvements and we think this is the best investment for those dollars?
Yeah, trust us, we're from the government, right?
Trust you, the Port Authority.
That's right. You are not. There will still be really good constraints and audit trails, but that's appropriate. I mean, these are our taxpayer dollars coming back to Allegheny County. Now, the trip through DC to come back, but we definitely need to be able to show our communities and our stakeholders what we're doing with that. And not just looking at a balance sheet, for instance, but there are environmental constraints that we're going to be looking at, because we want to make sure we're not, ruining a creek or getting rid of a habitat or really significant here in southwestern Pennsylvania. Let's say we extend a busway, but then we create an impermeable barrier and there's a flash flood. And now somebody's house is slid off a road because we didn't do the work, right? So that there's good reasons to have these things. There's also an increased focus on the federal dollars of making sure that we're investing in small businesses. And why is that important? You know, a small business just starting out, when we award contracts, we have to look, which is responsible. We look at the history of the vendors with whom we're working, right? But if you're a smaller business, you know, you just branched out, just hung up your shingle, you're not going to have that track record. And then the same few companies get all of the resources. The federal programs strongly encourage us to make sure our vendors are bringing on partners from smaller businesses. So we grow this field, we grow this community, and we grow the economy. So while it is a string attached, I think it's an excellent string that is investing our tax dollars locally. Now we will have different buckets of funding. So right now we've got, you know, we put a certain amount of money toward vehicle replacement. We put a certain amount of money toward safety and security. We will have specific buckets we're looking at here, again, for rail replacement, for instance, or maybe for, you know, infrastructure expansion or climate and equity. So it gives us more buckets. And I'm not saying that I love bureaucracy. Folks who don't work with me will say that that's not necessarily the case. But I think there's really good reasons to have these reporting requirements and these things put on this federal money.
Finally, the Biden infrastructure plan includes $85 billion for public transit. What kind of message do you think that investment in transit sends to cities across America?
Transit per capita in the U.S. is so underinvested when we compare ourselves to, you know, different markets, not just, you know, in Canada or looking overseas, where cities have made the investment. So you're free to live your life without a car, and cities are not spending so much money on parking and roads and these very low return on investment dollars. I think the strong message I see coming back from the infrastructure bill is that even during a pandemic where fewer people are riding, this is still a system that we should bolster. You know, and it's not just about who's riding at this point, it's how many jobs are close to transit. Are we close to medical facilities? Are we close to school? Does your transit service run frequently enough that you don't need a schedule, that you don't need to plan a 3-hour block for a 2-mile trip? And it's, you know, transit is transformative. If you don't need that car, what could you do in your world? Absolutely, the administration is supporting this.
Catherine Kellerman is CEO of the Port Authority of Allegheny County. David Huffaker is Chief Development Officer. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. In her photographs and public artworks, Njami Njie documents Pittsburgh's Black communities. Her new book of photographs combines personal history with social commentary about gentrification. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll spoke with Njie about the book, This is Where We Find Ourselves.
Much of the book is black and white photographs. They're these urban landscapes that you shot. Many of them memorialize things that aren't there anymore, things that have been replaced by other buildings or just empty spaces. How come you choose to go that route?
One thing I noticed as I was making pictures for this project last summer was that even in this time of uncertainty, even in this time of chaos, even in this time where so many people were losing finances and losing their livelihood, the city was building itself up and making itself over. And that was interesting to me. That was a little bit curious to me. And that made me think a lot about erasure. That made me think a lot about displacement. That made me think a lot about how things change and how things are forgotten. And so I wanted to take a moment, this very specific moment in history, to think about what things are and how things are right now before they continue to change even more.
Part of your family lived in Homestead in a neighborhood called The Ward that was leveled in 1941 for an expansion of the steel mill. You reference another kind of infamous displacement of Black Americans in Pittsburgh, the Lower Hill District being leveled in the 50s for the Civic Arena. We also have pictures of East Liberty, which is kind of the locus of gentrification in Pittsburgh today, and how many of those landmarks of the Black community are now gone and replaced by something else. And you talk about quote, places that change around us, but without us in mind. I wondered if you could expand on that a little bit.
There's a legacy of displacement of Black people, of Black communities in the city of Pittsburgh. And I found it interesting and unfortunate that, you know, my family has personal experiences in so many of these places. It feels like there's this generational loss that's inherited. I think my question for the city is, why do we as Black folks continue to have to inherit this loss? Because it's not that we don't make community. It's not that we don't continue to love each other and look out for each other. It's that generation by generation, there are systemically fewer places for us to make that community together.
The story of Pittsburgh, the history of Pittsburgh, is often taken as a very white one. Do you feel like your work is in some sense trying to address, to remedy that by asserting, you know, the importance of everyday Black life over the generations in Pittsburgh?
In my work, I do try to really shine light on and celebrate the many different ways that Black folks experience and move through our lives here in the city, not just now, but in a historic sense too. I think that it's interesting that a lot of the local narrative about Pittsburgh is so white, because the Black history here is so rich. And I do not think that you can talk about the history of Black America without coming through Pittsburgh. There have just been so many people that have made tremendous contributions to not just Black American culture, but what Black culture is worldwide. And so if I can, you know, contribute a little bit to that narrative, to just celebrating who we are and what we've done, not just in the grand, you know, history book sense, but in the day-to-day community sense, then that's work that I feel very privileged to do.
That was photographer and Jamie Enjai talking with 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll. The exhibition version of her book is on view at Silver Eye Center in Bloomfield through February 19th.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. We've been asking families for questions, those very good questions that a kiddo in your life might have but leaves you scratching your head. Today's question comes from Kat and is about the final frontier, space. We're turning to an expert today for some help. Mike Hennessy is the manager of the Buell Planetarium at the Carnegie Science Center. Kat wants to know, is the universe constantly expanding? So Mike, is it?
That is a great question, and the universe is constantly expanding. The universe began nearly 14 billion years ago, and it's been constantly expanding ever since. The universe began in the Big Bang, which was this sudden, rapid expansion from a very hot, dense state. And it's been expanding and cooling ever since. The Big Bang happened everywhere at once. We are living in the aftermath of the Big Bang. There was no space before the Big Bang, and it's not just that the universe is expanding out into space, it's that space itself is expanding. I like to think of it as expanding raisin bread. So if you're baking a loaf of raisin bread, the raisins don't get bigger. And you can think of the galaxies that way. They don't get bigger, but the space between them is constantly getting bigger. And that's like the dough and the bread that's rising. So just as raisin bread rises in the oven, the universe is getting bigger and bigger over time. Even though on our scale, the space between you and me, or between stars and planets, galaxies, they're all being held together by gravity, but the space between the galaxies is expanding over time.
How do we know that the universe is expanding? Because the universe is very big.
How do we know the universe is expanding? That's an awesome question as well. And there used to be two competing theories. One was that the universe was in a steady state, that it always was and always would be the same size. But we were able to observe the universe expanding. So first, there was the theory of a Big Bang. It was put forth by a Belgian cosmologist and a Catholic priest named Georges Lemaître. And then along came an astronomer named Edwin Hubble. But Hubble himself theorized that some of the nebula that we see when we look out into space weren't really nebulas. They were galaxies of their own, and he was able to prove it. There was a time that we thought the Milky Way galaxy was the whole universe. Edwin Hubble was able to realize that other galaxies like Andromeda, their own islands full of billions of stars, and over time he was noticing that they were moving farther and farther away from us. And he was able to observe what we call redshift. So if you think of the Doppler effect as a speeding ambulance goes by, the sound gets lower, right? As it passes by and keeps going farther, the pitch goes from high to low. As galaxies are moving farther and farther away from us, the light that we're seeing tends to shift like a Doppler effect into the red end of the spectrum, longer wavelengths. And what Hubble saw was the farther away those galaxies were, the more redshift he was seeing. And he actually was able to realize that all of these galaxies are moving away from us. And the farther away they are, the faster they appear to be moving. So everything's getting farther away from each other at a faster and faster rate over time.
If the universe is constantly expanding, does that mean that new things are being made to fill this growing space, like new galaxies or new planets or new stars?
So we see new stars and new planets still being formed today throughout our galaxy.
Mike Hennessy is the manager of the Buell Planetarium at the Carnegie Science Center. Mike, thank you so much for answering our question.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
And if any kids in your life have some good questions, send them to confluence@wesa.fm.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence. And through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.